To begin.
Hey, what is up, guys, and welcome back to another episode of the Social Primate Podcast. Today, we got the powerful Matt Cedillo. He is the literary director of the Mexican Cultural Institute of Los Angeles and the national coordinator for the World Poetry Movement of the United States. Dude, what is up?
I'm here, man. Live.
You're joining us here on a rainy LA day.
Yeah, getting out of the flood.
With that being said, man, give me a little bit of background. I know we had the opportunity before, maybe back like in 2020 or something, to have a conversation along with Viva Padilla, and then again, once again, like between both of us later on that year. But it's been a hell of a ride from what I've seen on Instagram, the stuff that you've been posting, and I know you have a lot of updates for us.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how long I was here, but since then, I think last time I was here, Mowing Leaves of Grass had just come out, and so the success of that book has been pretty wild. It's taught now at like UC Berkeley, it's taught at Madison, it's taught really all over the world. I say that, it seems surreal to even say that, but like, I remember I had this opportunity to go speak at in Mexico City at Unamactilan, Sesachinacopan, and Casa de California. So I was really excited to speak at those places, but you know, every time I kind of achieve something, I'm the type of person that like achieve a big success and I don't feel happy, I feel relieved.
Yeah, okay.
Like I did it.
Yeah.
And now it's over and now I feel sad. So now I need to do something else, right?
Yeah.
And so like I was like, okay, well, I'm gonna get my book taught here at UNAM. And so we're doing this event out in the community at a Cafe de Revolution or something like this. It was near the Zocalo. And so this guy comes up to me and he tells me, he says, it's an honor to meet me, blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah. And this trip was there with Luis Rodriguez, so I thought he was talking to Luis or someone behind me or something. And he's like, no, it's an honor to meet you. And I'm like, oh, okay. He's like, I teach your book. I'm like, oh, well, where do you teach my book? And he's like, I teach at UNAM, like the main campus. And so my book was already being taught at UNAM. And so I had this whole dream of like speaking like at UNAM. I mean, I got to speak at UNAM Actelan, but I want to speak at the main campus, right? And so that was my big dream. And so my book had actually beat me there, you know?
That's crazy.
And so the next year I got to speak at UNAM, at the actual UNAM, and I was actually on Radio UNAM. And so like that all happened. So that was pretty exciting. But yeah, the last time we spoke, you know, Mowing Leaves of Grass came out. And so that book has done really well. Also came out with City on Second Floor. That was the next book. And that book has done really, really well too. Maybe not as well as Mowing Leaves of Grass, but it's been in different spheres. And that one's taught actually in an American Studies class over in at the University of Napoli. Which, as well as schools here too. Yeah. But like that one's actually taught in Italy. So that's, you know, both books have, I love them both, but they're different from each other. Like Mowing Leaves of Grass, more like a history book, where a lot of history jam-packed in there. And City on Second Floor is a lot more like a sociological book, more like a Marxist geography, more like how the city and why the city is built against people. And it's just kind of how the physical structure is set up to exploit people, you know. So
and that's one of the things that from early on caught my attention, because a lot of your work, it speaks a lot about struggle, or, you know, and political stuff. You know, I've seen videos of you performing in front of a live audience, and the way that you engage, the way that you carry yourself, like you do the slow buildup to the point where you're like being loud about it, you know. You can't help but just have to look around and actually pay attention to what you're saying. And, you know, and when you start listening closely to what the content of the words that you're saying, you're like, holy fuck, it's full of references to historical moments, you know, movements. And you can't help but to walk out of that segment just fucking educated.
Oh, thank you, man. I appreciate that. Yeah. Definitely. I mean, it's written that way. I design it that way. I go over it again and again and again. And even a lot of the information that I want to have in some of them, it doesn't match. It doesn't fit up. It doesn't line up rhythmically. So I have to take information out, but I don't want to just leave it anywhere. So I have to create a whole other piece for that. Do you know what I mean? I often tell people with this, the way I write, and there's so many different ways to write, but I write like I'm making a mannequin, right? And I can have like sculpt some really great arms, but I can only sculpt two arms. I can't sculpt three arms because I'm making this mannequin. So let's say if I have three things that all function in the same kind of way, I have to move one of these things and put it in a different poem. It'll have that rhythm. Because if I don't do that, I'm going to be like, da, 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 da. It's gonna be like I'm lecturing you. But the fact of the matter is that the way it's written, it's so like that each part, each section of the poem, each like stanza connects the next part like puzzle pieces. And so it rhythmically sounds good. There's a musicality to it. And if I just feel like there's the content so good or the information so good, I'm like, well, I don't want to lose that. That just means I have to create another thing. I have to create another piece of music. I have to create another poem.
Yeah.
And that could be the center of it. But like, so this is everything you're talking about is not, it doesn't just happen. It's a lot
it's
of
a process.
It's a process, not just process with the information, but a process with the rhythm, a process with the sculpting and the patterning.
You think there's like an outline that you use consistently throughout each piece that you do, or is it loosely?
No. There is. There's like every time I'm brainstorming, there's a topic, details, point, act one, act two, act three, and another thing I structure this is like a four square, which is 1, 2A, 2B, 3A. So in one, we have, you know, we introduce the hero. 2A, we introduce the villain. 2B, the villain's winning. 3, the hero wins. Now, most stories are told that way. And what that means rhythmically is different things, but 2B is really the low point where it seems all hope is lost. There's no way we can go on. We're going to lose. So for anyone who else grew up in the 80s, this is like when Hulk Hogan's getting beat up, right? Yeah. And then all of a sudden, Act 3 comes along, he starts shaking his head. And he's building back up, right? So that's how I write. I write in that kind of like that classic structure of like we come in, we're highly energetic. There's all this like wonderful stuff. And then all of a sudden, there's doubt. And then all of a sudden, there's like extreme doubt. And then all of a sudden, we return to our confidence and how we started. But Act 3, the resolution of what thing has to be tied back to the intro. We have to win for reasons that were already introduced. We can't win for new reasons that exist outside of the piece.
That takes from the message, I guess,
right? From the message. Yeah, it takes from the message and also just didn't feel real. It's like, and I don't know where. And it's like, no, we won. So it starts off, we're beautiful, we're wonderful. Oh my God, we're getting fucked up. Oh no, we won because we're fucking beautiful. Right? So that's how it is. So it always has to have some kind of return. So I always try to end the way I began or end in a way that calls back to the transition from Act 1 to Act 2.
Now, for yourself, like, what was the key moment in your life that you got politicized to speak, like, very highly about these issues in your work?
I mean, so, like, okay, so when I was a kid, I wanted to be president. I think I already told the story. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I kind of remember, yeah.
Point. I get so used to telling the story and I act like it's like, whoa, I'll spontaneously respond. But anyways, okay, so I'll tell it again. Yeah. All right, so when I was a kid, I wanted to be president, you know, and my father, well, when I was a kid, I wanted to be president. Well, because my father taught me how to play chess, right? And then he never let me win. And then he would tell me afterwards, after, like, just beating my ass, being like, you know, like, now you're going to have to get a job, right? One day you're going to have to get a job. So he was like give me this horrible humiliating defeat and then be like, you have to get a job one day. And so I was like, all right, well, it's not gonna be a tournament chess player. And then I started one day I'm gonna be president because, you know, I could boss everyone around. And so I decided that's what I want to do with my life. And I learned the names and terms of all the presidents, and my mom took me to these high schools, and I would tell everyone where. And then one teacher tried to trip me up one time, and I knew the answer, and I knew it was a trick question. I'm like, that's a trick question. The answer's Grover Cleveland. And he tell me what year you're born, I'll tell you who was president. So even then, as a kid, I knew how to handle heckler, right?
Yeah.
I knew how to handle hecklers. And so anyways, but then I was 7, my dad says, you can't be president, we're Mexican. And I was like, oh, no. I was born in Monterey Park. I don't know what you're talking about. You know,
I totally get
like,
that.
That's not what I meant. And I was like, oh, shit. And so, but so that was, you know, that was really kind of those seeds of like, well, if I can't be president, why I want to do this? So then I always wanted to be an artist, right? But then because I want to be an artist, I wanted to be an artist that didn't write politically. I wanted to be an artist that made like really weird, abstract, you know, I wanted to write, you know, I wanted to be a writer, director, or filmmaker or something like this, but I wanted to create art that was for art's sake, and I wanted to create things that were not political propaganda. I had this weird, pretentious thing. I'm like 11 years old. I'm like the most pretentious 11-year-old. And living in El Sereno and Maywood at the time. So, like, you know.
Dude.
Yeah, my mom's side's El Sereno, my dad's in Maywood. They had joint custody. So I'm like that, like the most pretentious, kid.
Hey, you had fucking goals though.
I had goals.
I was 11 and I was like, fucking, I want the new Digimon game.
Well, I'm at 5, I want to be president. So I mean, like, you know, my goals kind of dipped, actually. They've been dipping ever since. Anyway, so these are my goals as a kid, and then I had to, you know, eventually I had to start, you know, I grew up and I had this idea of this novel that I wanted to write, and I was working on it for a long time. But, you know, then I grew up, I had to get a job. And like my dad said.
The fucking reality of fucking growing up.
And then, so I ended up working retail for many years. And so, you know, here I was, you know, very pretentious, very like, had these big dreams and whatever of what I should be. And I'm just like, you know, getting so bitter with everyone around me because I have like, I feel like I have so much to say.
Yeah.
And here I am folding shirts and, you know, nothing's wrong with doing that. But like, with the fact of the matter is I felt that like I had, you know, where, and the truth of the matter also is that there are, you know, opera, potential opera singers in the backs of kitchens. And there are people who can like, right. You know, there's Picasso's, working behind a cashier register at a gas station. I mean, there are just, there's. The success in the art world is all about connections and networking and doing all these type of skills like that, as well as having talent. And so there's so many people who are so incredibly talented, who don't actually get their artwork into the world. So it's not that my feelings of like I was born for so much more is not to degrade anyone who's working. It's actually to point out that and it's not even unique. There are millions of people feeling trapped in the daily grind,
right?
Who have so much art inside of them, and I was one of them, and I was very, very bitter, very, very angry, and so then I went to go work for my father for a little bit, managed the thing, and me and him fell out again, you know, because we're always getting fights, always getting upset, and I found myself in a really bad situation, and here I am, you know, all my life told how smart I am, and here I am in a really bad situation. What am I going to do with my life? So I started going to the library a lot, and I started reading all these books. I read these books about political economy, and I read all this Marxist type text, right? And I started reading this old text about how you organize, right? And I read this thing that said, like, in order to organize, you must be the most ardent worker. You must, you know, must show that you're not a complainer, that you're actually a hard worker, and that you were fighting for it. So I go back, and I'm working at Lowe's at the time, and I'm like, I'm in the garden section or something, and I'm like throwing things over my shoulder. I'm running, I'm scrambling, I'm moving, and busting the ass as hard as I can. And everyone there fucking hates me. Right, because it's like I look like kiss ass. I don't look like the guy the doing next work. I'm working hard for no reason, and now the management, you know, the management loves me. They hate me, and I'm like, fuck this. I'm going home. I'll go back to LA, go to Dallas. And so I come back, and then I'm working in retail again, and then I make some new friends. But now I'm politicized, right? Because now I want to put away my dreams of being a bourgeois artist and be a serious organizer of the proletariat, right? And so I have make a friend, and he was organizing at USC. This guy Dave Romero, right? And he was organizing at USC to get them to stop using sweatshops. And so we go to a May Day rally. I know mostly politically, and then afterwards we go to this open mic, and that's when I first saw spoken word poetry. And I heard it, and it was like knowing when you can like hearing a voice on the radio and knowing you can imitate it. I knew I could do this style of art. I knew exactly how they did it. I knew exactly what the patterns were. I knew exactly like how to like, okay, here's you introduce a concept. You do this. You move it around a little bit. You have a twist. You have a change. Like, oh, but wait. You're like, oh, my God. And then you have like, you know, like, no, man, I've done it. And this is my mother, my father, and I never got a chance. I knew how to escalate. I knew how to do all those things. I could put my own little touches on it. And so I was like committed to coming back and doing it more and more. And so that's the story. The story of my life, of how I got politicized was really just my own personal experiences. Mm-hmm. But I got more politicized by fighting the good fight. So the boy who would be president became the angsty teenager who wanted to make arts for art's sake, who became the man who some say is the best political poet in America.
Hey, man. I fucking agree on that shit. Because I think when you take the time to educate yourself and go out of your way, right? You went to the library. How many people do we know that I know, I would say, you know, I'm sure you know plenty of people, but that I know that I actually go to the library to go out of the way to get books to educate themselves consistently, you know?
Yeah.
Very limited, you know? Right. I don't even have a fucking library card. So it's like, you know, when are you taking the time to actually do this stuff? So, of course, you were in certain circumstances that led you to choose whether you wanted to go one route or the other, and you chose to educate yourself. When you did, you know, that just added it to that anger that you had, right? But you used that anger rather than in a violent, non-productive way. You chose to say, you know what, I can use this anger and help voice the anger that I'm feeling and the community is, you know, feeling at the same time.
Absolutely. Yeah. It happens when you educate yourself. And especially if the drive in you is to educate yourself, you know?
Right.
When you have that drive, that spark. But, you know, that you can inspire others and others, you can be inspired, you know? Mm. To do that. I mean, I think that's it. But like, you know, you can't wait for someone to be like consistently inspiring you. You have to like, once inspired, you have to be your own inspiration.
Yes, exactly.
To keep pushing yourself. Otherwise it's not going to happen. I mean, those people go, I mean, you think about, you know, there's all these people that want, you know, get advanced degrees, but they don't, they're not constantly surrounding themselves. Not all, I mean, many do, but they're not always like constantly surrounding themselves in the stuff they studied in college. In the same way mm-hmm. that all most of us go mm-hmm. through high school, right?
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember how to do trigonometry. I don't remember how to do algebra. I don't remember yeah. do the subjects I didn't care about. Yeah. You know, I don't surround myself with that stuff. So similarly, you know, college isn't much different. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So like, I think that, I think that people, you have to have the hunger inside you, and it has to be, and you have to keep the hunger inside. You have to keep mm-hmm. the flame burning. You know, and so I personally always want to be a lifelong learner. But that's what motivated me towards this like working class stuff. That we're, you know, the rich and the poor, and let's fight and this. Mm-hmm. I got motivated more to a lot of the Chicano stuff that I'm kind of a little more known for now. Later, mm-hmm. And that was really more with the Trump years. And it wasn't that I was ever not like Chicano. It's not that I was never not, or it was never that I was not like, you know, didn't tolerate racism. It was never that I didn't have a connection to roots or something like this. It was just that was not the point of emphasis, you know. But during the rise of Trump, I saw someone put out a very explicitly anti-Mexican message. Mm-hmm. And I saw all the people around me, all these like reds, all these people that were like, you know, fighting for the proletariat, saying that wasn't important. That what was important was to maintain a working class unity. That what was important was to understand the pain of people who Trump's message spoke to, mm-hmm. to understand the pain of the Midwest white worker, to understand the pain of the Rust Belt, to understand why they were hurting, and to show them that they had a class interest outside of what, you know, this racist message that was being put. And I was like, fuck that, you know, fuck mm-hmm. that, and fuck you for saying it, right? You know, this guy's saying Mexico's sending drug dealers and rapists. If you don't take that seriously, then like, you know, you don't take like my potential safety seriously.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
like, okay, fuck, yeah. fuck you, mm-hmm. right? And so that's how I thought of falling out with a lot of people, by taking hardline stance. And that's how I kind of really kind of bridged more into more of the Chicano movement. Mm-hmm. Not that I was ever apart from distinct from it, but that's what really made me put like kind of all my eggs in that basket, because I saw just how prevalent anti-Mexican rhetoric was mm-hmm. to, you know, current day fascism. I mean, and it really is. I mean, people will say all kinds of things and have all kinds of analysis, but facts are facts. If you look at the way in which Donald Trump, who is the leading figure of American fascism today and has been for, you know, a while, has been for like almost mm-hmm. a decade now, the key platform here is our border politics. And, you know, so it's anti-Mexican, anti-Central American. These are yeah. the primary talking points that he has. Now, he has stuff about Muslim bans. He has stuff, he's generally speaking, deeply sexist, you know, anti-black, all those things. But if you look at what he always goes back to, if you look at how the crescendos of his hate rallies back in the day, it always was build the wall, Mexico will pay. That uh-huh. was the high point. And so when I see that happening, people not taking it seriously, it became my mission in life to educate myself more than I already was, and then also to create dynamic art to express that. And so that's kind of where things stand today.
Yeah, for sure. Like anybody listening here, you know, whether wherever they stand, you know, we're either gonna, people are gonna be applauding us right now, or they're yeah. gonna be like, hey, fuck both of these guys, you know? So one or the other, especially yeah. now, you know, because we're it's a fucking election year first and yeah, foremost, course, so yeah. you know, things are using a gig, you know, funnier from here. So the idea is, you know, I think this is important to say, because I didn't really become self-aware, air quotes, self-aware, till I was in the fucking, you know, 2010s, you know, late 2010s is when I graduated high school. So my reality has been like, I'm just a brown kid. I live in a fucking brown community. I don't experience racism. Racism's gone, you know, yeah. there's none of that going on. However, once you start reading, right, you start fucking finding out all of the movements that have been happening over the last fucking 60, 80 years and shit. Yeah. You're like, wait a second, I've been painted this way for so long. Even before, you know, there was fucking signs that says no Mexicans, no dogs. And it's like, dude, what the fuck?
Right,
you know, and it's something that we forget because we're not seeing it, you know, and it's not until you start digging deep and you're like, wait a second, this shit actually existed. You know, people were getting fucking lynched during the gold rush in front of fucking mines to kind of scare people off. And they were usually Mexican people.
Yeah.
And, you know, just one of a lot of fucking things that have happened. But it's easy for us to forget that happened because it's not in front of us.
Yeah.
We're not looking into it.
Yeah.
And then when you have somebody like, again, you're standing up for a message that when taken out of context in any form, you're like, dude, this is targeting specific people.
Yeah.
You know, you're categorizing them and you're putting them in a box. And now everybody who fits in this box, you're going to fucking lash out at them.
Right. And like you or I or whoever, you know, the average, you know, person living in Southern California of you know, Mexican descent, compared to like on the world scale, you know, you could say that, well, we're not really that impoverished. We're, you know, if you compare it to like, mm-hmm. you know, people who like, you know, in mine, you know, children in the mines, so, yeah. you know, in Africa, or somebody starving in Afghanistan, or people starving in Mexico, or you know, whatever, or even you know, people unhoused people here in Los Angeles, you could say like, okay, well, it's not that bad as that, but the conditions that we find ourselves relative to the general population, relative to mm-hmm. whatever, those things are, there's a direct tie between that and what you're talking about, the lynching of Mexicans in the 1840s, yeah. in the 1850s, and 1860s. There's a whole reason why we're not taught our own history. There's a reason why we're not taught that history, and it's tied to this kind of erasure of this message that we don't have ability to fight back. And so really what has to happen is we need to raise the demand, and in the raising of the demand, we're going to get attacked, we're going to get targeted, people are going to be like angry that we're even bringing it up, you know, and it's going to come from a lot of our own people. We're like, you know, why are you talking about that? You really should be talking about this, or you really should talk about this, or you really should talk about
yeah.
this. And, well, you know, like, your analysis says this, but I think it's lacking in this.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point where you can't even get to anything.
Mm-hmm.
There's no point to the idea that, you know, and the reality is that it's not just that we need to learn this. Everybody needs to learn this. The oppression of Mexicans is a fundamental part of the development of the United States. That this whole area that we live in is built off the backs of like the Bracero program, of like these things. It doesn't happen without the exploitation, the super exploitation of Mexican labor. It just doesn't. I mean, if you look at the time period in which Phoenix, in which Los Angeles, in which San Diego, in which all these cities become bigger and grow into major mega cities, this is between the periods of 1930 and 1960. Like, this is all the backs of Mexican labor, right? So this is all during that time period. And so we don't really know that. And with, like, the oppression of Mexicans in the United States, the oppression of Chicanos in the United States, is fundamental to the way of the development of law, because the resistance is fundamental to the development of law. Who do you think Mendez was? I mean, not Mendez. Who do you think Miranda was? What kind of name is Miranda?
Yeah.
Ernesto Miranda. Miranda versus Arizona. Yep. You have the right to an attorney. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney. Da, 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 da. That comes from a case against a Mexican guy, Ernesto Miranda. I mean, what comes the legal precedent to Miranda is Escobedo versus Illinois. That's Danny Escobedo.
You know, I never even thought about that.
What kind of name is Escobedo? Right? So 1964, Danny Escobedo, 1966, Ernesto Miranda. Both these things come from that history.
Mm-hmm.
The legal struggle against these things come from that history. So the right to remain silent, which applies to everybody, comes from that particular history, that specific history. The phrase, the thin blue line. You see this blue lives, the blues line, flags, or, but that comes from that blue line through the American flag, that fascist symbol, right? That phrase, the thin blue line, comes from William Parker, but in a show that he developed called The Thin Blue Line, in which he would explain why the LAPD was doing whatever they're doing at the time. Well, that show came out following Bloody Christmas, and Bloody Christmas was this night where when they rounded up all these Mexicans, they all got drunk and they all went down. They all, you know, like 60 drunk police officers went down and beat up like about 11 Mexicanos.
Locked us up.
Yeah. That was called Bloody Christmas. And because of Bloody Christmas, Parker developed a thin blue line. So this concept of the thin blue line also comes from, mm-hmm. you know, the history of the oppression of Mexicans.
This is exactly what I mean. Like, you're talking about these things and I'm just like,
people don't know these things.
Yeah, for sure I don't know these things. And maybe it's like, you know, again, I don't take the time to go and fucking read all these books. But again, there was a point that you said right now about like the information. Like, sometimes you want to bring out these topics, you want to have these conversations on specific things, issues that do need to get addressed.
Yeah.
But then you have another person or another group coming in and saying like, well, you're not talking about this, so we shouldn't talk about your thing because you're not talking about this either. And it's like, bro, we got to take a time to talk about each and every issue for sure. But we can't just try to combine everything at once. You know, sometimes you just got to focus on one problem first before you start trying to bring everything.
I honestly think people like that need to leave the room. No, I'm serious, man. They leave the room. Leave. Because this is this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go to McDonald's and try to order a pizza.
Yeah, right.
I'm just straight up. Like, this is what it said. This is what the door said. This is what the this is what the flyer said. Mm-hmm. This is what I'm gonna talk about. Yeah. Straight up.
For sure. There's the door. You're getting the information straight up. Like, hey, this is what we're gonna fucking talk about. Okay. All right. Yeah. Cool. We're not going to go in there, like you said, and just start asking for, like, hey, well, we fucking got to talk about fucking how to make donuts.
That's what people do. People walk in, you know, to a burger joint and try to order a hot dog. And people do it all the time. And that's what they do politically. I mean, politically, that's what people do. They walk into something and it's about this, and they demand it be about something else. People do it all the time. And it's not unique to Mexican question. Right? I mean, people do that all the time with all kinds of stuff. You know, people, you know, we're going to do something about an environment. And somebody walks in and just starts, like, you know, talking about, you know, like, well, you know, the bank foreclosed on my house. Like, you know, like, very important. But that's not what, you know.
Yeah. No, but again, it's about taking the time to if you want to talk about it, make your own fucking thing, too. You know, let's make a fucking your own thing and be like, make it about that specific issue. You know,
right.
Then let's get those people there. Yeah. And again, at that point, you can build progress rather than just everybody screaming at each other or to the point where everybody else just walking in gets disconnected immediately because they're like, oh, what the fuck's going on? Just drama.
Yeah, drama.
I'm bouncing, you know, and then you don't get nobody's message out.
Right. And yeah, but I think that's the point. I think that, yeah, in many ways, I try to play defense or something like that. But like, yeah, man, I don't know. I don't worry about Twitterians, you know, people who just live on the internet. I don't worry about trolls. I mean, like, you know, it is what it is. Yeah. But like, you know, it's funny to me. I mean, a lot of people just make up this, like, really, they're just like word salad specialists. They just say these things that don't have any, like, bearing. They don't have any cohesion. They just, like, they jump, like, centuries. They don't have a timeline, or, like, a factual timeline, or dates or stats or this. It's just all just these, like, word games, you know?
the word game,
but I don't.
Yeah, no, I totally.
I want to talk about how great I am. I don't want to talk about how weak they are.
Well, you know, I did want to talk about, like, right now, right? So you've seen a progression in your work, right?
Yes.
Like in the evolution of it. Like, where do you see yourself, like, diving into right now?
Well, I mean, this year, I mean, I got a wild schedule this year. This year, I'm gonna be in Mexico. I'm gonna be at the University of Guadalajara. Then I'm gonna be at UNAM. And after that, I'll come back, and then I'm gonna go to speak in Italy, and so I'm gonna be actually in first I'm gonna be in Ravenna, and I'm part of the Dante's Laurel presentation. So 2 years ago, I won the Dante's Laurel. So I won this Dante's tomb. I was presented by these monks, and they put a real laurel on my head. Yeah. And this year they're gonna give it to a guy named John Fosse. So I'm gonna be part there. And John Fosse just won the Nobel last year, so I'm gonna be a part of this ceremony. With a Nobel Prize winner. Yeah.
Oh, damn, bro.
And then after that, I go to Rotterdam in the Netherlands, and I'm going to do some readings out there. Then after that, as part of some theater group. And after that, I'm going back to Italy to be part of Pesaro 24. Every year, Italy selects a city to fund for some cultural whatever. And so I'm going to be part of that. I'm going to be kind of like one of the major nights, you know, like highlighting. I think they're calling it contemporary American poetry. Yeah, it's really... It's really interesting. Every time in Europe, they always want to ask me about the beats. It's kind of funny. Like they like, you know, like,
what do you mean,
know,
like the beats,
the beat poets, Allen Ginsberg and like Jack Kerouac and stuff like that. So they always want to ask me about beat poets, beat writers like that. And so because they think of me as like a beat, and this is very strange. Which is like, yeah, I just go with it, whatever. So then that's Pesaro, and after that, I'm going to Hungary. I'm going to be in Hungary. I'm going to be at the University of Szeged, which is the second largest after Budapest. I'm going to be speaking at an American Studies conference there, where a lot of my work has been translated to Hungarian. And so they're going to be doing, you know,
dude,
they're going to do a big thing on me. And then after that, man, I'm going to Serbia, and then I come home. But then after that, I go to, I think, Cuba. Mm-hmm. I think Cuba's next. Yeah, then I go to Cuba. I'm going to speak at Casa de Americas after that. I was invited to the Medellin Poetry Festival in Colombia, so I'll be in Bogota. Then after that, I'm working on some stuff in Chile. I was still kind of in the works. And after that, I go back to Mexico.
And this is all this year?
It's all this year.
That's going to be fucking awesome.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you're going to walk out of it, like, you're going to feel like you had a psychedelic trip. Like,
yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, well, last year I was in Mexico, I was in Italy. I did a 9-city tour of Italy because my book had got published. So my book got translated into Italian, and I have an Italian publisher, and they brought me out there, and I did a 9-city tour of Italy. I got to read Venice at an international poetry festival. I got to read,
That's fucking awesome, man.
Yeah, man. I got to read I read the Guadalajara Book Fair, which is the largest book fair. It was first or second largest book fair in the world.
You went there to read a part of your book? Oh, damn.
Yeah.
Sick.
Dude,
that's fucking beautiful, man. It's beautiful to hear, do that.
Yeah. No, it's weird. I'm more accomplished than I am famous. So it's like, because I have trouble getting press because no one wants to write about me because, you know, an asshole or whatever. But like, no. I have trouble getting press for some reason. But like, I'm actually, you know, it's weird to even talk about. But yeah, I've read at the Guadalajara Book Fair, which is like.
How does that make you feel, man? Like, just, I mean, first of all, you gotta prepare for it. How long is the longest stay?
In Europe, I'm gonna be gone for a whole month. So, I mean, I'm gonna be in Italy for a few days, like 3 or 4 days.
Then
I'm
okay. So, a couple of days in each place.
No, I'm gonna be in Netherlands 4 days. Then I go back to Italy. I'm there for like 7 days. And then I go to Hungary and I'm there for 12 days, I think. I think that's what it is. And then I'm in Serbia for 2 days. And then I come home. So, that's kind of.
That's nuts, man.
That's nuts,
dude. No, that's why it trips me out. Because I mean, you've had your share of fucking moments, you know, in your life where you're like, fuck, you know, like you don't know whether you should keep doing it. I'm pretty sure, you know.
Yeah,
at some point, you're like, nah, fuck, what are you doing? Like, get your head out of the gutter and just focus.
Yeah.
And now you're just fucking traveling, dude. Just doing your work.
Yeah. No, it's really great. It's really. It's really great. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to say about it. I mean, I think that I don't know. It's kind of surreal to talk about. It's kind of strange. Like for many years, I felt like I didn't get the credit I deserved or something like this. Because like, you know, it's like you said, like the work so layered and whatever. And so I'm just like, yeah, man, I worked really hard on this and I did all these things. And people were like, yeah, he's great, but like, you know, but nothing. I'm just like, yeah, he's great. It's like, no, man, I'm like really good. Like, really, like, no, it's a different level. And now I feel like it's being recognized. And
hey, that's cool, man.
Yeah.
You got to do the work, you know, you got to do the work. And, you know, sometimes it's easy to forget that when you're in the struggle, you sometimes you don't see a light. You're just like, fuck, you're just rock bottom. And that's all you can focus on. Nothing seems like it's going your way.
Yeah.
But sometimes it just takes that little like thing to connect you, like, you know, that hunger, right? Like we go back to that hunger thing, that drive that you don't want to be in that situation. And then you either choose something that's going to fucking fulfill you or something that's just going to continue you in that same cycle. And a lot of the times it's easier just to focus on that cycle because we have a lot of escapes, you know, we fucking porn, fucking alcohol, drugs, whatever the fuck it is. You know, we all have our fucking vice. But regardless, like, you know, do you focus on that or do you fucking step away from that too and focus on your shit and get it done?
Yeah, no, I'm such a workaholic. I mean, I work. I'm always like thinking about it. And I don't even know. I enjoy it though. I enjoy working. I enjoy the process. I enjoy doing things. I love having a beginning, a middle, and an end. You start something, you work on it, and you finish it. You start something, you work on it, and you finish it. And I think I don't really know if I enjoy necessarily the fruits of my labor as much as I enjoy the labor itself. Mm-hmm. In fact, the fruits of my labor sometimes makes me a little discomforted. I feel like after I accomplish something, I just feel just very like, well, what next? I mean, I always have the what next really fast. I mean, everybody experiences what next, but I experience what next in like 30 seconds.
You know,
like,
fine, that's
you know, cool. It's not like, you know.
Yeah, because
like,
that's a very,
you know,
it
like,
can
you
be very.
Spend like a week or what, and just like this blissful like state of like, I can't believe I did it. I'm always just like immediately like, what's next? And so that's something I need to work on in life. I need to really enjoy. I need to enjoy my life more.
I mean, dude, you're going to be traveling. What will you do on a regular night? Like, once you're done, you're just going to go out, I'm assuming, right? Go out about just exploring shit?
I mean, it depends. And if there's networking to be done, I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
Because I'm not thinking about, like, oh, I'm having such a great time here. I'm like, how do I get back?
Yeah.
And how do I get somewhere else? Right. So, like, if I'm in the Netherlands, I'm thinking, like, how do I get to Belgium?
Yeah.
You know, how do I get to Portugal? How do I get to, you know, like, I'm always like, how do I, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
And so I'm not really into, like, you know, this is great. I'm always like, how do I?
Yeah, okay.
How do I get more stuff? So, I mean, but like at times, I mean, when I went to Mexico, it was a little different, right? So in Mexico, it's really interesting. First time I went to Mexico City to do work, I think I spent most of the time connecting to something, you know, almost like spiritual, something before, something ancient, you know? And I got to go to Tepito, and I walked, you know, where Cuauhtémoc was captured, and where he was tried, you know. And there's two, you know, there's two, what do you call it, plaques to recognize that, right? And one's on a church. Mm-hmm. And so you think about the, you know, what is the symbolism of that? That's on a Catholic church. And here's where they captured Cuauhtémoc. It's kind of like, it's unsettling, right? And I remember sitting there and feeling this, like, this feeling that I couldn't really explain. You know, and it felt like really like this deep pain in my heart, this deep recognition of something, this deep whatever, and then also just the anger that it was on the church. And I almost felt like I was going to cry, right? Mm-hmm. Then went to go see the second plaque, and that plaque is on an auto body shop.
Right. Wait,
what? Yeah. Well, you know,
my guy went for emotional right after that.
Yeah. Mexicans, we're not gonna like let space go to waste, right? So like, you know, there's a plaque, but also we gotta fix these cars, and I couldn't cry there, so I had to let it go. So I was like, oh, what the hell? Yeah. And so that was my first experience there. It was all this connecting to the pre-Columbian past, all this connection to this deeper, like, you know, this deeper indigenous root. That was my first experience in Mexico City. My second experience was like, no, I want to see the real Mexico. I want not the real Mexico, but I want to see the modern Mexico City. I want to see the Mexico City that people that's similar to Paris. You know, that people from all over, you know, the Western Hemisphere came to. There was an intellectual hub in the 20th century until today. But I mean, that was, you know, where heroes like Fidel Castro came here, and Che Guevara, they met here in Mexico City, and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you know, he lived here for a while, and all that kind of stuff. I want to see all that. So I went to, you know, the Cafe Havana, and I went to these other places because I'd gone to Rome, and I got to go walk where Pasolini had walked, and I got to go to the cafes where Pasolini was. And so I'm like, well, I needed to have that kind of experience in Mexico City. You know, I can't just be doing this. I can't be like treating this like this ancient thing and then like, you know, go to Rome and like fuck the Colosseum. I want to go where Pasolini was. Well, I got to do the same thing in Mexico City. So I'm doing that. So I go to the Cafe Havana. It's great. You know, here's all the stuff, all the history there. You can feel it, you know. And then I went to see some other stuff. Like, I think we went to buy where Octavio's Paz used to drink and you know, all the difference of that. And then finally it was like, okay, we're going to find Gabriel Garcia Marquez's house, right?
Nice.
And it's supposed to be like a museum, but it get there. And it's not. It's just a street with rich people, and some rich guy bought his house. And everywhere you walk, the cameras are pointing at you like this.
Oh,
and so I'm like, it's time to get the fuck out of here. Because in Mexico City, you don't want to be anywhere where it's too poor. You don't want to be anywhere where it's too rich. Because, like, either way, you know, it's going to happen, right? You want to stay in the middle. Because, you know, like, it's, you know, if you're in like a rich neighborhood and they feel like you don't belong there, it can go bad quick, right? Especially if you walk around like a tourist, like, I think this is the house. You're like pointing at things with them. Yeah, so I'm like, all right, let's get the hell out of here, you know. So we kind of got out there, and it actually puts you right next to the UNAM campus, so that's there. So it's cool.
Nice. Okay.
But anyways, that was my experience in Mexico City most recently.
Was his house like still like the OG house, or was it fucking modernized?
It was nice. I mean, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, even if the map thing was correct. I mean, who knows? I mean, just
that's
like
a random neighborhood.
It just looked like we were in a rich neighborhood. That's all it looked like. You know, it's like, oh, man.
Nah, yeah. That's cool. But again, you still walk out of that. You know, at the end of the year, you're gonna walk out with like the whole experience of like, you know, you went fucking around the fucking globe.
Oh man, yeah. I mean, like that was pretty deep. I mean, Venice. Venice was amazing. So I got to read at an international poetry festival in Venice. And Venice is interesting because there are parts of Venice that look faker than like the Venetian in Las Vegas.
No fucking way.
Now, there are parts of Venice that are so touristy, they look cheesier than Las Vegas making fun of Venice, or Las Vegas trying to look like Venice. There are parts of Venice that are cornier than the corny imitation of Venice, right? Because it's so just built for tourists. And so you get there and you're like, what the fuck? This is awful, right? And then like, you see these guys just singing exaggerated accents of like three or four Italian songs we all know, like, oh, sola mia. You know, it's like really exaggerated. The gondoliers, like, what the hell? And then you walk, a few different blocks and then you're in real Venice. You're in like the real ancient one. You can feel the history of that place. You can feel the real, you know. And so it's just, that was a pretty powerful experience, just walking around and just and I walked all the way to the edge, and you know, I started just thinking about whatever. And so it was funny because I started just thinking about the people that, like, this is how I am though. I'm like, I turned into this negative thing. I was like, I think about all the people that hate me, and I'm like, you know, take this, here I'm in Venice, you know, like, you can just see me now. And so I wrote in a poem, I was like, you know who walked to the edge of Venice contemplating only haters, thinking of the villain in every story is a hero in another, thinking of the hero of every story is a villain in another.
That's fucking cool.
Yeah but so Venice was amazing. You know, Mexico City was amazing. Cuba, I mean, when I got to go to Havana, that was an incredible trip. That was when we mm-hmm. talked. Yeah, maybe you just got back from Havana.
That's what 2019 you guys went or something?
It was 2019, right before the pandemic.
Yeah,
right before the pandemic. So that was the last hurrah. And so like when the pandemic kind of ended and the world kind of opened back up, mm-hmm. you know, that's when all my travel, my real international travel, really began. And so I kind of had this mentality that like, oh yeah, like I'm blowing up. But then if I'm honest with myself, I was about to blow up, and the pandemic fucked
yeah.
me up.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, fucked up a lot of people. I'm not saying like, and I alone suffered. No, I mean, like, we all had the same bad year.
Yeah,
right?
But that's when everybody had to take a step back and just like, yeah, yeah. fucking recollect.
Because the year before I was in Havana, I think the year before that, not too long before I was in Havana, mm-hmm. I was at Cambridge.
Oh fuck. Okay, yeah. So you already started getting that.
Yeah, I was already. Yeah, so I was at the University of Cambridge, then Havana, the Casa de las Americas. And then the world stopped where, and then the world opened back up, and there I was back again. Like at UNAM, this, that, the other. So like, I feel like, I think I was hitting my stride just before the pandemic hit, and then into the pandemic, I did some projects, and they were cool. And now things are just, you know, things are going well, man. Things are going really, really well. Things are going really well, and I'm very happy, and I'm very lucky, and yeah. I'm very fortunate, and I'm very grateful to all my collaborators and friends and people that have made things possible. I mentioned earlier, you know, you asked me about my origin story, how I got started. I mentioned earlier David Romero. David Romero is actually a really good friend of mine, great poet. He's traveled some like 34 states. You know, he's also traveled internationally. He actually, me and him co-founded a press, El Martillo Press.
Is that your guys'?
Yeah, this is my head.
Oh,
yeah.
Fuck, no way.
I own the press. And me and him work on it. And so, yeah, we founded a press together, and that's been going great. We published some people, mm-hmm.
That's sick.
Yeah, we published Donato Martinez, Cesar K. Avalar, Paul Flores, Flaminia Cruciani from Italy, Margaret Elisa Garcia, mm-hmm. Wrote The Daughterland, great book, Cesar Avalar, Paul Flores. And so, yeah, I encourage you to check out elmartillo.com, check out all our great authors. We're very, very proud of them. We wanted to found a press that was very much, we wanted a press that kind of people wrote and had kind of like working class values. We wanted mm-hmm. A press of people that we felt at one point or another in life, you know, had to either work the cash register or push the broom. That was kind of our mentality.
Man. It goes back to the conversation that you said that sometimes, in just the most basic jobs that you walk yourself into, you know, as a person walking into an establishment, right, to be a fucking consumer. Yeah. You just assume that these people's roles are just their fucking roles in this location, yeah. But little do you know, like when you find out, like, oh yeah, I do fucking DJ overnight or something,
photographer
or something, you're like, oh damn, this guy knows the struggle of balancing the creative aspect of his life and the fucking just
it's
9 to 5, and I think that's normally how it goes, because obviously you need a form of income to kind of support your fucking stuff.
All right.
You know, but one thing that I like that you did was that you created the space, you know, like maybe the space wasn't there, or maybe it wasn't in the way that you were kind of, envisioning, but you went ahead and said, you know what, I'm going to make it and I'm going to find people that are similar.
Well, yeah. So El Martillo Press, it's coming an outgrowth of Flower Song Press, which is out of Texas. So that's Edward Villare. And so Edward, he did Flower Song Press. He's great inspiration to us. I mean, he published so many people. He's about to publish his 100th book. So, you know, very, very proud, Edward. I think I was like his third or fourth Mowing Leaves of Grass. So that tells you, like, that came out in 2019. Damn. And so it tells you that in like just that time period, in like about 5 years, he has published like 100 books.
Damn.
He's averaging like 20 a year. Yeah. Edward does it at a different level than we're doing it. But we intend to publish like all things go right, like 10 a year. So that's not quite 20, but 10, which is still much more than most people. So, that's what we're doing.
That's cool. Yeah. Cause I mean, I know like there's like services like on like Amazon where you like send your stuff out and they do publishing and stuff, but it doesn't beat having, you know, supporting a fucking local group or an organization around you that's actually trying to, you know,
right.
You know, well, provide a message.
So we ended up getting our authors readings at Book Soup, at the Achuchas, at the Village Well, Arvorita. We got them two up north, one at the Beast Crawl. We also got them reading at Litquake. So we got our readers a lot of readings, probably about 15 or whatever. And you know, Amazon, whatever, is not going to do that for you.
Exactly.
They're not going to get on the phone for you. University presses oftentimes won't do that for you. Mm-hmm. I know someone who got published by the University of Chicago, and the University of Chicago got mad at them for actually trying to market the book. No, I'm serious. It was horrible. they tried to, like, you know, they were trying to get their book reviewed, uh-huh. and they were sending it places, and they were doing it like just basically, hey, here's my book. I'd like you to check it out, blah, blah, blah. And the people that run the newspaper contacted the University of Chicago Press, and they were like, hey, don't ever, da, 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 da. And so, then they ended up chastising him. So it's like, mm-hmm. well, not only are we not going to do the work for you, we're also...
Hey, I mean, Amazon's not going to do that shit. But again, it goes back to the thing. When you build the connections, it's important because that's going to get you pretty far. You know, you have to collaborate. You have to be open to discussion with people. And just even if you're not in the right or in the same grounds, you know, at least be open to like, hey, I can provide this for you. And, you know, you become available and, you know, growth comes out of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Dude, that's fucking cool. I mean, again, the whole Martillo, like, what was the idea behind that? Like, you guys just needed to have more power, or you want to empower more people? Or...
Well, no. So we were working with Flower Song. We were working with Edward. So we both got published with Flower Song, and we had kind of a special relationship with Edward that we were trying to help him build up the West Coast wing. Mm-hmm. And so, I made some suggestions to different authors he should publish, and there were a lot of them were people who were interested, and he told me some people he was interested in. I kind of talked to them. I talked up Flower Song to them. This is when he was just getting started. Now he can ever get on the phone and call anybody because the brand is built up and people love it. So, you know, but this was when it was just building up, and mm-hmm. so I was kind of like his little kind of West Coast rep, right? And so that was like how it kind of started. But at the end of the day, we mm-hmm. wanted certain people published, and Edward had this guy published 100 people a year. I mean, 120 people a year. He's got this backlog, this huge backlog.
Exactly.
And so we're like, all right, well, we'll do like a little imprint, you know? And then it was kind of like, well, we'll do, yeah, we'll do, and it was like, you know what? We're going to do our own thing. And so we ended up doing our own thing. And that's how El Martillo got started. But I bring this up, and I don't mean any of this negative in a negative way. No. I love Edward. But it was just, it came out of the growing pains of having wanting to start something that was a, kind of a part of Flower mm-hmm. Song or part of a subsidiary of it. Because I really wanted to synergize that energy, so it just becoming not wieldy, not right, didn't quite fit right. So mm-hmm. we did our own thing, but we're still great friends.
Yeah,
of Flower Song Press, and we still are very much, I don't know, like sibling presses, I guess. Or we're very much we support them, they support us.
Yeah, no, I mean that's good. Sometimes you gotta outgrow things, and that's fine to do that too.
Yeah,
not necessarily outgrow, but just go separate ways sometimes. It always sounds negative. But it's not
always,
negative.
It always sounds
it's
negative. Negative.
But no, I get what you're saying. Sometimes you just gotta expand in separate ways.
Yeah, you gotta expand. Yeah, the only way to expand is where it's just it didn't fit with it forever. And then,
and at that point, I mean, again, you're just helping kind of fill a void that maybe that place wasn't necessarily covering. And now you have that, and then you guys share like this relationship, and again, it just becomes a symbiotic thing, where everything's like fucking flowing and helping each other.
So absolutely,
That's what matters, that's how fucking things work out. But to be honest, I'm a little too high fucking right now, man.
All right, well.
I just noticed a few minutes ago. I was like, "Fuck, bro, my mouth is dry as fuck." It's okay, but going back to your stuff. No, seriously though. So the latest stuff that you released, I know you've been doing a lot of. I saw more videos on YouTube, and I saw one of the poets that are like, or the poems that really like fucking got me feeling riled up was The Devil.
Yeah.
Like, tell me a little bit of background on that.
The Devil. Well, I wrote The Devil because I wanted to write. I don't know where that idea came from, but it was like, I was like, all right, I'm gonna write this, and then this is kind of one of the three act structure kind of started coming. I'm like, all right, so first part, mm-hmm. The Devil's gonna be a salesman. Second part, the devil's gonna be. Like a politician slash, the politician. In the last part, mm-hmm. the devil's gonna be like a mega church, right?
Yeah.
And so that was kind of like how I knew the structuring was gonna happen. So I just started doing research. What am I put here? What am I put there? 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 And I just started figuring out like that. So as far as I heard it say I was sucker born every minute. And it starts talking about it started talking about just like Exxon and Chevron and Coke or Pepsi, Adidas or Nike, Ford or Chevy, a Mac or PC, a college education, reverse mortgage, you need deep in the blood of the Congolese. So I was talking about all this like business stuff, and then the next part starts out I'm a Washington lobbyist, I am Fred Thompson, Jack Abramoff, Dick Cheney, you best pay me, I'm the reason why you can't fight City Hall, but I can buy off Supreme Court justice, I am not so that was the part where there was about the law and politicians. The last part was I'm a businessman. The poor you shall always have. I am what Caesar takes. even with whether or not you're willing to give it, you know, I am da-da-da-da. Motherfucking devil, you know?
Dude, and you fucking, the way you build up to it, honestly, reminds me of like a fucking metal song.
Yeah.
You know, like it starts off slow with the fucking riffs, and it starts building up, and then you're just basically like, you know, I think there was a video, I think, who was it, Elephant on YouTube or something, one of those. You were doing the devil.
Yeah, Elefante,
Elefante, there we go. Dude, that shit was fucking powerful.
Yeah, so so it builds up into crescendo, right? Uh-huh. And so like that all comes from the way it's written. It's not just that I'm just doing it while I'm saying it.
Yeah.
I write so that it comes off like rising action, you know? So like, you know, it's like, I am the motherfucking devil. And I run this shit. The fuck you gonna do about it, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I was in. So if you look at the other poems, like even the ones that are historical where I'm not playing a villain, it's like, you know, like from, he goes like, you know, from Lone Star Republic, Christopher Columbus, all the way down to Donald fucking Trump. We didn't cross the borders crossed us. Who are you calling immigrant? Pilgrim. Right? So it always has that kind of, that big climax and then like some like little like sarcastic comment, some little shitty comment, like,
yeah.
You know, yeah.
But I love how you fucking ended. Like again, you use Ryza and it just kind of just kind of like drops and it's like, dude, that's some powerful shit.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's fucking beautiful. For people to find more about your work,
go to elmartillo.com. I have to update my own website, so like don't go there. Go to elmartillo.com. You can find out more about me. Go to look about the MCILA.org. Find out more about the Mexican Cultural Institute of Los Angeles. You can find me on my socials and stuff like that. I'm coming out with a new book this year called Mexican Style. So be on the lookout for that. Do I have time for one poem?
Yeah, go for it, dude.
All right, so this is a poem from upcoming Mexican Style. A Chicano poet sits at a desk and attempts to pen an anthem, a classic, a grand-sweeping epic of economics, demographics, the fear of a brown nation on a bronze continent. The motive engine, the beating heart of the Mexican question, Chicano condition, has somehow lost in a land of confusion, American neurosis, and Hispanic serving institution. Chicano poet sits at a desk and attempts to dive into ink, into parchment, open letter. An honest ledger of wins and losses, martyrs and marches, the mothers of East Los Angeles, crusades for justice, just for janitors, the Justice Eight, Los Siete de la Raza, the Boulder Six, the Vasquez Rocks, the Silver Dollar. Chicano poet sits at a desk and attempts. A ranchero. Vaquero. Bandito, Goro Blanco, Bracero, Pachuco, Brown Beret, Inmate, Cholo, Vato, Loco, Pocho, Nosabo, Kid, son and heir to all I have seen, but taught to forget the crimes they commit, then omit from the text. I changed the law when they stole the land. I taught our kids they held no claim, took too much space, that I changed their names. They come a long way to nowhere. I saw a Chicano poet sit at a desk and attempt a hope, a dream, a prayer. May I spend my days and nights scouring the archives of a lost tribe that stitched every thread of history and culture they could find and called it home. May I carry the move in my heart, wear my heart on my sleeve, and enshrine our heroes in these poems. A Corona, Acuna, Tianuka, Caesar, Dolores, Gomez, Quiñones, The Plan, the Santa Barbara, San Diego, Catalina, La Tierra, Amaria, Tejarina, Alorista, LRU, UDP, CSO, ATM, a rifle, and a press, a pen, and a sword. It's like Flores, Daniel Gangi, Flores, Magón. It's like 500 years, and 500 more. Batista, Cortina, Jovito, Modesta, Morena, Barrera, Cabrera, Ayala, Carrasco, Cardona, Munoz, Muñiz, Ruiz, La Raza, La Cronica, Regenera, Sean, it's like Luche, Asigue, Asili, Rodriguez. I return to the court, I Corky, I walk in, and I look the same, and I feel the same, and I've survived centuries of genocide and war, race, politician, right-wing militias, pseudo-intellectual academics calling our good name. It's a question, a movimiento estudiantil, a Chicano, that's land, and I shall endure.
Dude. Thank you for doing that on the podcast.
Thank you.
Do we got a little bit more time, Amaraj? Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I would love to talk a little bit about that in the new book. Dude, what the fuck, man? How? Tell me a little bit about this poem. I mean,
oh yeah, it's called A Chicano. And what I wanted to do was, I wanted to write a poem, that was kind of like in conversation with the poem I'm Joaquin, right, written by Corky Gonzalez. And so I Am Joaquin is like this 15-minute long poem where he talks about the history of Mexico, and he talks about the history of Chicanos, and he talks about all this like long, you know, all this why sweeping history. So I wanted to like write that in like a shorter period. So but I also want to do it in this kind of weird meta way, right? Because I want to do this like almost being John Malkovich kind of way. So it's a Chicano poet sits at a desk and attempts to pen an anthem, a classic, a grand sweeping epic of economics, demographics, the fear of a brown nation on a bronze continent. So these are all phrases taken from different parts. And so am I the Chicano poet, you know? Or am I telling the story of a Chicano poet? Am I telling the story of Corky Gonzalez? Who is the narrator of this? Mm-hmm. Right? So that's kind of like, you know, that's the first part. So as I tell you that Chicano poet sitting down in this, and then I proceed to try and do that. Right? And so then like the next part, you know, a mode of engine, the beating heart of the Mexican question, Chicano competition, now someone lost in a land of confusion, American neurosis, and Hispanic serving institution. So land of confusion and American neurosis are actually taken from the poem I Am Joaquin. Mm-hmm. And so it's a reference to I Am Joaquin. And then the next part of the poem, it lists out these like historic struggles. So it talks about the Mothers of East Los Angeles. It talks about the Crusades for Justice. It talks about Justice for Janitors, the Justice 8, which is currently on right now. Yes. Los Siete de la Raza, which took place back in the 70s. The Boulder 6, the people who were killed fighting for ethnic studies in Boulder. The Vasquez Rocks, where they captured Vasquez. And the Silver Dollar, where they killed Ruben Salazar. So these are you know, martyrs and Marxists. Yeah. And so it's a whole list of martyrs and Marxists. And this is like, you know, Chicano poet sits at a desk and attempts. Ay ranchero, vaquero, bendito, Goro Blanco. So Goro Blancos were the original people that kind of fought against, against the wave of American invaders, right? So, or again, after the Mexican-American War. And so that, you know, takes you the history of like what happens after the Mexican-American War. It goes from being ay ranchero, vaquero, bendito, you know, like being demonized, Goro Blanco, bracero. Pachuco. So it goes from being the landowner, like we're, you know, being proletarians, right? Bracero, Pachuco, brown beret, inmate. So I'm taking like from that to now to criminalization.
Yeah.
So I'm taking to like the Chicano generation, but I'm also taking the mass incarceration generation. So brown beret, inmate, cholo, vato, loco, pocho, no sabo kid. So pocho means like, you know, I'm disconnected from Welsh culture. No sabo kid means the same thing, right? Yeah. So pocho, no sabo kid, you know, son and heir to all I've seen but been taught to forget. And then so it starts with the history. And then it moves into like, you know, my goals. Like, you know, may I write a hope, a dream, a prayer. You know, may I spend my nights scouring the archives, you know, of a lost tribe. You know, meaning like people always saying that Chicanos have no culture, this or that. Or, you know, you're just putting together these little pieces of this and this, the old threads. And you're sewing together something that's not, you know, you're just making it up, right? Yeah. It's like, well, you know, well, yeah, you're disconnected, right? So we're creating something, something powerful enough to resist, to resist this thing, to whatever. So, and it's taking pride in that fact. And so, see, I have a thread of history called culture they could find and called it home. May I carry the movement of heart where my heart must leave and shrine our heroes in these poems. And then I started listing out all these heroes. Because a lot of these people I see attacking Chicano studies, they don't know any history. They don't know anything.
Right.
And so like listing out all these different people, all these different things, or all these different things you can look into. Bert Corona, Rudy Acuna, then I went on to talk about Emma Tanayuka. You know, these are all like academics and organizers and, you know, field organizers. Cesar Dolores, obviously. Gomez Quinones, who was instrumental in so many things. Juan Gomez Quinones. And so then just the list goes on. It goes on and on throughout the poems. These are all names of people who actually do things. Who've made important contributions. Yeah, and that's
ooh, and for so, the fucking vaquero line, that shit is fucking hard, dude.
Yeah.
Dude, and it's fucked up because, I mean, that is where we stand, you know? And you know, when you say the whole no sabo kid at the end, it's like, dude, that is reality because unless we take responsibility to teach the fucking youth, the kids that we're starting to raise ourselves as parents, you know, people creating families, that culture is going to be washed out.
Well, the culture is going to be washed out, but see, it's not just about the culture, it's about the history.
Yeah.
And the history explains the current conditions. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So there's a reason why, you know, Montebello is not as rich as Santa Monica. There's a reason why El Monte is not as rich as is not rich like Pacific Palisades. There's a reason where our communities are filled. There's a reason why we're working for them. Mm-hmm. You know, and those reasons are tied back to ranchero, vaquero, Goro Blanco, but, you know, the reasons why we find ourselves in the positions we find ourselves in is tied back to the history, that history. And so we need to know that history so that we don't like just look around and just blame ourselves. We don't blame ourselves for substandard education. We don't blame ourselves for having jobs where we're getting our stolen wages. We don't blame ourselves for having to take, you know, for basically our positions here. We don't blame the community as a whole for the fact that we have such high incarceration rates. We don't blame, you know, the community as a whole because we're getting shot by the police. We don't blame, you know what I'm saying? Because if you don't know that history, if you don't know that long line of oppression, you just think that the world is the way it is because it's the way it is.
Yeah.
That's what you're going to think. So this whole, you know, the fact that, you know, that so many of us know Sabo is a very big problem. And so we got to really, and that was a joke. I know it's no Sabo kind of. So don't think like, aha, he is it.
They're like, got him. Yeah. Nah, but no, dude, that shit was. So is this something you've been working on for the new book specifically?
The new book is so, you know, Mowing Leaves of Grass was definitely a Chicano Studies book, but I think that this book, Mexican Style, is much more about, it's much more about Chicano identity than the last one was. The other one's about like history and fighting back. This one is really about a lot of people reaching for to something to identify with, right?
Yeah.
To find themselves. So that poem is there, but then there's a poem in here called Bandolier, and it's about it's like a Dia de los Muertos poem where people are talking about a family member that fought in the Mexican Revolution, and they're trying to reconnect to that because her brother's been shot by the police. And she's trying to reconnect, find strength in the Mexican Revolution, you know. But obviously that happened like, you know, over 100 years ago. And that's near, you're living here. Yeah. Blah, blah, blah. But they're trying to find strength in that. Another one's about a pair of friends who, you know, they grow up, you know, in L.A. And, you know, with all the conditions and problems and whatever. And they bond over the Mexican golden age in cinema. So, you know, there's all these just different examples of people trying to connect to something. There's another one about a tagger who takes on the name Denemis, meaning you will live, you will travel. And he tags up this train, so he may never see the whole country, but his art will.
Fuck.
You know, and so like that becomes this whole story about him. But he connects to this indigenous past in order to connect to something, in order to not be nothing, which is what this country will tell us what we are. And so that's what the book Mexican Style is all about.
Dude, that's powerful, man. You know, that's I've mentioned this a lot for the last fucking podcast, but you know, that's something I've been looking through myself, like the identity, like just reconnecting to, you know, parts of my fucking background. And it's like, and you know, that's something that I feel like a lot of us are going through, especially you know, again, we start hearing on the fucking news, you start seeing like this thing again with the whole, you know, it's going to happen every fucking election year, the border stuff going on, like immigration, like, you know, they're trying to get their votes. But nonetheless, you still see that they're still using that as fucking a pawn in the fucking game. You know, it's like, dude, you're using lives at stake, you know, you're using people as just fucking things for your plaything, you know?
Yeah, so, it's disgusting.
But when does the book come out?
Should be out May 5th.
May 5th. Okay, cool. So we got plenty of time to help fucking push that. Yeah. All right, man. Well, I mean, if you said if people want to find you, you said the website or on Instagram, you said?
You can find me on Instagram. My name is Matt Cedillo, MattSedillo. And I assume there's going to be a thumbnail for this clip, right? So I'm the Matt Cedillo that looks like me.
All right. Sounds perfect.
Yeah.
All right. Well, dude, thank you again. And we'll see you next time. Peace.
To wake up, it's time to wake up.
Let's get it.
Look, a visionary and a living legend. I work with both crews, our first impressions. The best you never heard, only here to apply pressure. The microphone, my weapon, no tech up on my dresser. I'm with a dime with no cam in my hand. Just the AC, I'm blast, I call it the only fan. Cause social media now is so embarrassing. Put a stock in bullshit and following false narratives. And me, I give you truth in real life. Face to face shit, delivered in real time. Cause many messages you receive be misleading. Taken out of context, shallow, no deepin'. My company flow incorporated for the teaching. A prequel to the villain on some KMD shit. Gotta read between the lines, Jedi mind basics. Rhyme say you're causing ruckus, talent never wasted. Ayo, we back outside till the worlds collide. Can't hide behind the screen, it'll ruin your eyes. It's time to wake up, try to get a moment to climb to a higher level, ending in the rebel survives. Yo, we back outside till the worlds collide. Can't hide behind the screen, it'll ruin your eyes. It's time to wake up, trying to get a moment to climb to a higher level. In the end, the rebel survives. Yeah, another day, another dollar, that's a regular view. But get distracted or distorted when you turn on the news. A clear channel non-existent when you following fools. Either you get it or miss it, how you applying the tools. I got to encrypt it like hieroglyphics with good intentions, but born with a soul of mischief. Riding solo up Mob Deep, we stay gifted. Pull up to the function, roll one and stay lifted. Tomorrow never guaranteed. You're feeling more conflicted when you're looking at your feed. Why you think they call it the black mirror? The second that you look in the way, you see clearer. So don't believe the lies caught up in the picture. The silicone you inherit just makes you die quicker. That's why me and Damon only bring the authentic independent contractors, killing the frauds in. Hey yo, we back outside till the worlds collide. Can't hide behind the screen, it'll ruin your eyes. It's time to wake up, try to get a moment to climb to a higher level. In the end, the rebel survives. Yo, we back outside till the worlds collide. Can't hide behind the screen, it'll ruin your eyes. It's time to wake up, trying to get a moment to climb to a higher level. In the end, the rebel survives.